Welcome to Civil Discourse. This podcast will use government documents to illuminate the workings of the American government and offer context around the effects of government agencies in your everyday life. And now your hosts, Nia Rogers, Public Affairs Librarian, and Dr. John Augenbaugh, Political Science Professor.
Hey, Augie.
Hey, Nia, how are you doing?
You know what? I'm great because we have Chris Burdett back for our second half of our episode. And you had asked a question and I cut you off because I was being more important. But now we get to ask him more questions. But in the meantime, how are you, dear?
I'm fine, notwithstanding the fact that we'll have yet another episode of where Chris Burdett will go ahead and make fun of me. I don't know if my fragile.
I feel certain because I'm about to remind him that that door is standing wide open and he needs to walk through it, which I feel certain he's ready to do because you asked him about votes of no confidence.
Well, I'm contractually obligated to make fun of John. I need to put that out there. This is not something I have a choice.
Yes. I mean,
glad that you stayed with us for a second part of the episode.
When we hired Chris, I don't know if I shared this with you. When we hired Chris, one of the questions we asked him during the interview process was that was he willing and capable of making fun of his colleagues? And he assured us.
Batted it out of the park.
Oh, yes, he did. And he continues to demonstrate that on a daily basis.
I said only under duress, but all right, so please. So I'm just going to let the audience try to figure out what John has hanging over me.
Yes,
I have many thoughts about that at many people at the university that they must have information on other people. But anyway,
John Augenbaugh, extortionist. Anyways,
right. but you had asked about a vote of no confidence, and I agree that that's an interesting question. I'd love to know the answer. So, okay, wait, let me back up and say so. The people elect MPs, and
that's
the
right.
MPs are clearly from mathly broken parties, which we will not get into. See first episode if you don't know what I mean about broken math. But anyway, once they get there, then the people who have the most seats elect from within their group a prime minister. Now they elect them. Do the members of parliament elect them? The people don't get to have a say in that, right?
Well, indirectly, right? So, you know, we talked a bit about how you don't have a direct election for the prime minister, but during elections, you have the party leader. So you have the kind of incumbent prime minister who's out leading the party in the general election. And if they were to win the most seats or the majority of seats, then that's going to be the prime minister. So there's not a lot of, there's clarity. And no party is going to campaign without someone out in front. But ultimately, that individual is going to be elected from their own district along with all the other MEPs. So they're kind of equivalent. They're equal to each other at that moment. But when they arrive in parliament, then they come together. And if they have that majority, then they just elect their prime minister from their ranks. But it's presumably the person that was out campaigning as the presumptive prime minister if the party wins. So, you know, that happens.
Is that who we vote to have no confidence in?
That is, it's about the government, right? So this is kind of a constitutional, an unwritten constitutional question in the UK, where you have to command the confidence of parliament in order to lay a claim to legitimate authority, right? Because parliament represents the voice of the people. So if the voice of the people doesn't support you, then how can you make a claim to be a legitimate authority, right? So that's a very kind of political, philosophical angle to take to this, but that's really the way that they frame this whole thing, the way they frame the idea of confidence. So one mechanism that exists is the idea of a vote of no confidence, which, as the name implies, it says the parliament no longer thinks that your government is legitimate. It doesn't support you anymore. And so it's like imagining this, like, so you've got the government coming up with legislation, and then it takes the legislation, puts it before the House of Commons, and the House of Commons then votes on it. If the government commands the confidence of the House of Commons, then its majority is going to ensure that its legislation passes. When there isn't confidence, the government comes along with its legislation, says here, House of Commons, vote on it, and they're not going to. So that's not a government anymore. You are not governing at that point. You've got all this legislation. You're saying, oh, you know, vote this in, and no one is. So that is where the system breaks down conceptually, and what justifies then this idea of a vote of no confidence that says, okay, you no longer should be in charge, and we need to do something different. We need to have some other alternative. So in that British system,
how often do we see votes of no confidence? Super rare. Okay.
In the UK, super rare. If you look at other parliamentary democracies, they can be a little more common. And some people argue that votes of no confidence are in parliamentary democracies are going to be a source of instability. But we find that there is a certain reticence to use them. You can threaten them. And that's happened more recently in the UK Parliament, where you've had the threat of a vote of no confidence. But votes of no confidence, at least ones that pass, I should clarify that, ones that actually force a government out are super, super rare. In fact, I mentioned the last one was in 1979, and the one before that was like, I think, in the 1920s. So that's a long time where you have this mechanism that can conceivably throw a government out. It just doesn't. It doesn't work. Now, and that's where, you know, you kind of have this idea of you can have a vote of no confidence, but it doesn't pass. And that's a great way to signal to the government that you better do something. You better change what you're doing.
Yeah, because
it's a shot across the bow. Okay.
Because I was going to ask you, I mean, even just the mere threat might suggest to the prime minister and their cabinet ministers, you know, if you will, that they need to make some significant changes. Is this where you sometimes see, you know, turnover in the, you know, various ministries? Okay.
Can I ask that question too? What are the secretary? Where do they come from? The secretary of Bob's your uncle, the secretary of grass growing, the secretary of, I'm like, don't they have 465 secretaries? Like, Are they similar to our cabinet in that sense? Are they cabinet positions under a prime minister, or are they?
Well, I think the difference between like a secretary and a minister is important. A secretary is more like a career bureaucrat, whereas a minister is an appointed official. Okay. Power to appoint comes from the prime minister as the leader of the cabinet. So that's what they do have a cabinet, and that functions as the executive, and the ministers are department heads, and then they sit in charge of various bureaucracies that make the British government go. They generate legislation, they implement the legislation, there's oversight within these bureaucracies. So they have the bureaucracies that do what bureaucracies do, but that's the government. When we talk about the government, that's the prime minister and the prime minister's cabinet, but ultimately it's the prime minister that has control over it. John, Augie, you're right. One way to kind of signal that you're paying attention to the fact that your authority may be slipping in the parliament is to throw out your ministers and say change is afoot. And that can also be a way to reward different factions that might be forming within your party that are destabilizing and threatening your premiership, because there is that internal party dynamic that we can't ignore. It isn't self-evident always that the most popular MP from that party is going to be prime minister. I mean, it certainly isn't something that you can gauge from any of the elections that send these MPs to parliament. There's no one who's going to turn and say, well, you got 30% in your district, I got 55, therefore I should be prime minister. It doesn't work that way, right? But it's a lot of internal party dynamics. But I digress. I mean, you know, to kind of circle back to this idea, though, of that vote of no confidence, I do want to clarify one thing that I may have been a bit confusing in the way I expressed it, was while the passage of votes of no confidence are rare, right? And that's just a majority of the parliament has to say, yeah, we have no confidence. The use of them is more common. And that's oftentimes a signaling effect. And you can actually even have a sitting government saying, all right, let's have a vote of no confidence as a kind of put up or shut up moment where you have some dissension and you try to, and it's really a lot, it's less about the opposition at that point, because the opposition is always going to vote you out. It's within your own party that you have to worry. Yeah.
You could call it on yourself.
Yeah.
And you basically say it to the rebel rousers. Okay, if you really want, if
bring
you
on
really,
your vote of no confidence.
Yeah, if you really want change, then you're going.
Oh my great googly moogly!
Yeah,
if Augie was prime minister, he'd have a vote of no confidence every week.
Well, I'm telling you,
say to me, bring it with a vote of no confidence or shut up.
It works. It works in a number of ways because it puts the pressure on those MPs to decide whether their principles are that important. And to their jobs, because we have to also acknowledge that party leadership, which is nested within, if we're talking about the government, it's nested within the prime minister, party leadership. The party leadership makes a lot of decisions about how much, who runs in a district, you know, what kind of support you get within the campaign structure. Like, so you run that risk if you want to see the collapse of this government. You also run the risk of just maybe even losing your seat. So that has a way of kind of firming up support among what we call the backbenchers. Those are the MPs who are not in positions of authority within the party. They are the grunts there to vote on legislation, but they're not the ones who are making a lot of the decisions. Their support is essential, but you have to galvanize their support and make sure that you can rely upon it, because then we're back against or back to that question of, is this government legitimate? Because when your backbenchers start to defect, when they stop voting for your legislation. That's where your majority starts to wither away. Even if by numbers you have one, your legislation is going to be harder and harder to pass. So governments, like right now, with a more comfortable majority, can weather the storm if you have some defections. It's where those majorities are razor thin that those defections start to really make a difference. And that's where you can use some of these votes of no confidence as a way to actually discipline your party and not just say,
remember Neil, when we've had a series of conversations on this podcast episode about why Republican speakers of the House currently continue to deal, you know, interact with that 7, 9, 12, you know, extremists in the party. Well, they have to deal with them because their majority is razor thin.
Right.
Now, if
they
their if their majority was, you know, 25, you know, 35 or 40,
they could just be like, eat dirt.
Yeah.
Eat dirt. Know, yeah. Matt Gaetz, I don't care what you think.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing. But and again, this is where party dynamics come in. I really liked how you described that, Chris. Party dynamics. Okay, explain so much, right?
I think that Chris just gave the perfect description of what passive aggressive is. The British Parliament is passive aggressive.
Well, I didn't mean to.
but the British Parliament is passive aggressive. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they're all
up
in your
face. Well, that is definitely a passive.
Oh, yeah? Then I'm calling a vote of confidence, and we'll see what you do about it. Okay. All right. Like, I mean, it's fascinating. Wait, so you said secretaries are bureaucrats. How do we get secretaries, like the Home Secretary or a secretary of something?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I should say, excuse me.
Appointed by
that's a titular difference. They're still, the upper echelon is typically going to be appointed by the sitting government, and that's the case too. Even amongst our bureaucracies, you'll see leadership turn over within departments, because clearly if you have a different legislative agenda, you don't want someone who isn't ideologically aligned overseeing it. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. So you push out that leadership. And if you're that leadership, then you kind of don't want to be there either, because you're going to be asked to do things you don't ideologically agree with. But I want to come back to the vote of what happens if a vote of no confidence. So if it's a rare thing and a vote of no confidence passes, then the government resigns and you go to the polls, more than likely. The government still has to go to the king, in this case, and say, King, we've lost the confidence of parliament. Can we have another election? The king could say, you go back and fix things. No, but that's not how the British system would work. The king will do what the government says needs to be done, and there would be another election. One of the things, though, when we say how rare they are, one of the phenomena that we also have to consider is that sometimes a government sees a vote of no confidence ahead of them and they resign preemptively. So in effect, it's the looming threat of a vote of no confidence. Even someone who said, I'm going to make a motion You know, it could be even that explicit, or it can just be, I know that we don't have the support anymore. And rather than wait until they have the distinction of losing a vote of no confidence, which,
Confidence.
as I've mentioned, is a pretty it's a rare thing, right? They'll just go ahead and go to the king and say, yeah, we need a new election. I no longer have the support. And they haven't had a vote of no confidence, but the outcome is kind of the same. They've given up
Is
early.
that common?
It's more common than but in recent years, no. In recent years, we've had a lot more the more common phenomenon would be the use of a no confidence vote within the party to galvanize support within your backbenchers. That's more common than a government going to an election early because they anticipate a vote of no confidence in the British system. In other systems, it is you're going to
Yeah.
find it varyingly. You're going to find variation. But in the British system, no, it's that even that isn't that common. I'm just saying it's a possibility.
Okay.
And so I'm assuming that resigning is career ending. If you go to the king and you say, I have lost confidence, I as the prime minister have lost the confidence of my party, of the parliament, I'm resigning. That seems like that would be career ending, and yet we get Bojo,
So,
who is like, and I'm
well,
not trying to be
he is.
ugly, but he's like the cockroach of British politics right now, right? In that he cannot be killed. There could be a nuclear bomb dropped in London, and Bojo will survive.
So I'm gonna go slightly off. I'm gonna go on the
Sorry,
tangent, not slight tangent. No, no,
Boris
no, no,
Johnson,
no.
not
I
Bojo.
know who you're
I
talking.
shouldn't
Yeah.
call him Bojo like he's my friend, because he's not my
No.
friend, but also I shouldn't call him that, because
I actually kind of like that. I mean, that's I'm gonna start adopting
Whoa, whoa, whoa,
myself.
whoa. I
Whew.
call the head of the Supreme Court J-Rob. So, like,
I was
I
about to
have
say, Nia.
loving
I mean, really?
nicknames.
Really? You want to treat British politicians with kid gloves, but American
Nah.
government officials? Okay, we've been like hanging nicknames on them since this
Huh?
podcast has been in existence,
Yeah,
right?
that's true. I'm
Well,
just going to go back and call him Bojo because that's what I call him mentally. But anyway.
I'll say this: Boris Johnson's probably as far out in the hinterlands now as he's going to be. I don't see his career reviving, and that has a lot to do with more recent issues that have come up over COVID era policies, the parties that he was
The
throwing.
parties.
So, and by the way, I think I can do this here because none of us have a stake in this. If you haven't watched it, there is an incredible, I think it's ITV that produced it. Kenneth Branagh is Boris Johnson, and it's a mini series that tracks Johnson's policy decisions when COVID was hitting Britain initially. I mean, first off, that he nails Boris Johnson. It's kind of eerie and incredible because Boris Johnson is very much a cartoonish kind of character. I mean, and he, and I'm not, and I know that he's not sitting here somewhere saying, how dare you? You know, you're not, the Corbynites are already going to write, Boris Johnson is maybe his fans are maybe doing say, no, he cultivates that image. So that we call
He
him
messes up
cartoonish
his
is
hair before he
probably,
walks out the door. Like it's an
that is
intentional.
deliberate. That is
Yeah.
deliberate, right? But he that miniseries is worth watching because it gives us a little more
Okay.
insight into kind of that dynamic within his
Yeah.
administration that only really comes to light later. But so you asked about what happens when you resign. You don't necessarily find your career disappearing. You see a bit more of resign and come back. In the 60s, 70s, 50s, 60s, 70s. As you remember, like, for example, I mean, you can even go and, lose an election and you can still have you can still have a career afterwards. Churchill, that happened to Churchill.
Yeah.
But more recently, though, what tends to happen is if you either lose an election and you don't think that you can recover that ground, then you've lost the support of your party. You can remain in parliament. Theresa May is an example of that. She
Oh
actually had a
yeah,
bit of
that's right. Yeah.
a renaissance where she was actually relevant again because she was critiquing Boris Johnson's government for a point because he kind of, I won't say he ousted her, but he certainly played a part in pulling the rug out from underneath her when the opportunity rose. So you have that, you kind of fade into their backbenches. Then you can have people like David Cameron, who lost the Brexit referendum. He didn't lose an election, he lost the referendum. He resigns the prime ministership, says, I'm just going to become a regular MP. That lasted for like a week, and then he's out on the farm, and now he's back as a diplomat. So you've got kind of these changing career paths that can happen. And
nice.
You know,
nice.
So yeah. I think it depends on a lot of factors, like maybe how narrow an election loss there was. Maybe it, you know, whether your regime was, your administration was corruption ridden, like Johnson. There can be a lot of those things that come into play. So there isn't, in other words, a typical outcome that happens when you resign. But convention typically, they kind of tend to fade. They don't necessarily leave parliament, but they become kind of a backbencher themselves.
So I'm sorry, Augie, I keep asking all the questions because I'm just fascinated by all of this. The MPs, do incumbents have an advantage in the same way that they have an advantage in the United States in terms of money, in terms of name recognition? I mean, we know that incumbents, Augie, they're reelected like 97.7,000% of the time or something.
Yeah, it's usually 90-95%.
I mean, isn't it some?
Okay, but I mean,
it's a huge.
But there is a variable
advantage
here.
to have already won is a huge advantage.
But there is a variable that maybe Chris can address whether or not it's relevant in British politics. Remember, one of the reasons why incumbents do so well in the United States, particularly in House elections and state legislative elections, is that their districts are gerrymandered. I mean, that's a huge contributing factor. Does gerrymandering exist as a political phenomenon, Chris, in British politics?
That's a great question. I didn't even think about that.
You have what are called like safe districts. And that's a similar idea. I mean, gerrymandering implies intention behind the way that districts are drawn. That isn't necessarily the case, but what you have are districts where it would require a demographic upheaval for the voting tendencies within that district to change. So you know that you're going to, if you have a safe district, then you could put up the absolute worst candidate in terms of qualifications, but as long as they are your party, then they're gonna be elected. So you have those, and
is a working class neighborhood. It's going to be a labor person who goes to parliament unless they stand in the street and do something so heinous that we just can't vote for them. They're going to end up being the
Yeah, so that's safe. That's kind of how there's similarity in that idea. You know, you gerrymander to get the safe district. So in this case, you kind of just have these by virtue of the demographic patterns that exist.
Of the population. Yeah.
All right. The voting tendencies in that area.
Do Labor and Conservative broadly line up with Republican and Democrat or no?
Oh, good. That's a good question. I think it depends, right? So Blairite Labor, Tony Blair, Labor under Tony Blair was very much with some differences that we could attribute to kind of European sensibilities with respect to things like, you know, having a national health system or certain nationalized industries that we wouldn't see a Democratic candidate necessarily advocating for here in the States. But you saw like, Blair and Bill Clinton campaigned together. They were part of the third way movement. And so in that way, you saw Labor kind of look a lot more like a modern party, because from really until Blair, you had Labor trying to appeal to working class labor. I mean, that's where the labor comes from. Like it's labor union support. It's support of the working class. But with Blair, the modernization, it was more about being kind of young, the youth movement within the party. So appealing to labor unions wasn't quite going to cut it. Instead, you might appeal to things like socialized education and healthcare, things that electorate might respond differently to. That Jeremy Corbyn, since you mentioned him previously, yes. he tried to he was cut from that old labor union cloth. So he was brought up. I mean, he cut his teeth in a Labor Party that was wedded to labor unions, and he was trying to pull labor back in that direction, but he coincidentally found if there was a chance for him to even have a shot at the PM at becoming prime minister is when he actually found that there was youth appeal, but he couldn't tout the same policy mix that he would have dearly wanted to. So Labor then, to get to your question, and apologies for the
no to get there. No, this is actually pretty fascinating because there's a follow-up question that I'm going to go ahead and tie to the changing demographics of the political parties in the United States.
There is that kind of ideological alignment. So we can put them on that kind of a political spectrum of left and right.
Right.
And the differences between them are not huge. Again, it's just one of those, with those cultural policy interests are going to be different because of the way that the British system works. They're going to be those issue differences that exist. But we could say Democrats are left, Labor is left, conservatives are right, Republicans are right. And then they all have their blend of people that go way further left and way further right, and some that gravitate more toward the center.
So the question that I kind of sort of alluded to a few moments ago was, you know, here in the United States, the demographics of the political parties, we're beginning to see some shift, right? So, right. You know, the base of the Republican Party has become it's populated by folks who don't have college degrees, right? Mm-hmm. And the Democrat, I mean, you're almost seeing an inverse relationship, right? The Republican Sure. Party for decades, you know, was populated by well-educated, wealthy Americans. But now you see more well-educated, wealthy Americans voting for the Democratic Party. Chris, are you seeing that kind of demographic shift among the conservatives in labor in Great Britain?
I think that all right. So if the Conservative Party is,
How would you describe them demographically?
Right. Yeah.
That would probably be better. I mean, how would you describe, you know, labor and conservative parties demographically? What are their bases like?
Well, you kind of have the idea of the landed gentry would be the throwing their lot in with the conservatives, you know, wealthier business people, might be voting conservative. And then you also have the aging demographic, the age cohorts, I guess is a good way of putting it. Your age cohort for the conservatives probably trends more toward the older generations than labor, which has been having greater success polling amongst the youth. And some of that is about the policies, and some of it's about Brexit, because, you know, you had a lot more of a concentration of youth vote in favor of staying in the EU, and the conservatives hung their hat on being the party that was going to take Britain out. So that also kind of pushed some of that youth vote toward labor, or at least even toward maybe some of the third parties, but Labor benefited the most. And I want to correct what I was saying about Corbyn. Corbyn, actually, there was a moment where Corbyn, the polls, it could have gone either way. It was when Theresa May called a snap election that people were like, why'd you do that? And it was very much you don't really know why, but she came back. She didn't improve her. She didn't. Well, yeah, I think it was one. I think it was one of those moments where she's like, things are going to get a lot worse for us. So if mysterious. I don't do this right now. Oh yeah. Right. I think it was her looking at things getting really, really bad for the conservatives. So if they were going to try to maintain their hold, they better do that election now. And that was the moment where you had support. This is before you had the change in the electoral law. So you had to have support from the opposition. And the opposition was like, you're joking right now. So they left it that chance. It's like, we might be able to win this election. And that's when you had Corbyn, who up to that point was, everyone's like, you know, here's this dyed-in-the-wool laborite from the 1950s running the modern labor party. He's out there campaigning with the youth vote, and for a moment it looked like that might be successful. Now that it didn't work out that way, Theresa May returned with just enough to get by.
Yeah, I recall that. Yeah,
right.
You mentioned the B word, Brexit.
Oh yeah.
Now, Brexit, by the way, for our listeners who are not familiar, Brexit is a meme, right? British exit, Brexit. That's where the phrase comes, or the word comes from. Nobody actually, I think, intended at the beginning to call it that, and then it became the hipster cool thing to call it. But
right.
So basically, from my point of view, Brexit was Britain saying, we don't want to be part of the EU because the EU is too European for us. We just want to go off and be British on our own, you know, God save the Queen kind of thing. And they didn't, I'm sure there's more nuance to it than that, but that's what it looked like from the outside. And so the level of fussing involved in this was enormous, wasn't it? I mean, aren't there still people who are mad about Brexit this number of years later?
Oh yeah, no doubt. I mean, and you know, your characterization of kind of the origins of it is fairly sound, right? This dates back to where the issue of European integration was on the table for British politicians, and you see that there is kind of a love-hate relationship with it in the Conservative Party. And while you had some in the elite and then in the rank and file that were in favor of it, you also had offsetting the members that were against it. And while the conservatives ultimately, you know, here's a little tip or a little bit of trivia for you. The Brexit referendum was 2016. Was there another Brexit referendum? Now, I know the answer to that. The answer is yes. There was a referendum in the 1970s. There wasn't a referendum in the 1970s. And what's kind of surprising about it is that was a referendum where you had a bit of unity emerge between Labour and the Conservatives. And Margaret Thatcher actually was, at that point, a newly christened leader of the Conservatives. And she led the party into the referendum to vote, yes, we will stay within what was the European community at that point.
Yeah.
Now, and that's kind of
really Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah. It's historically ironic, right? Because,
I mean, you would think that her as a person, like, she would not be, she's very, very pro its own thing. And it's weird to me that she would want to be part of the European community. But when you think of it in terms of the financials, it is better for the tiny little island to be part of a larger group of people who do all the trade and all the other stuff together than for them to say, nah, that's fine. We'll just hang out in the North Sea by ourselves. I mean.
Right. Well, and that's in your the economic argument was at the time fairly convincing. There was also a sense of sort of like, I call it like a buyer's remorse, because the parties that negotiated the European community and then previously the European coal and steel community reached out to the British and wanted them to be a part of it. And the British demurred, and the negotiating parties ultimately said, we're tired of waiting for you. So you can go off and be on your own, like you say, off in the North Sea. We're going to go ahead with this. And then you have years of development of institutions and rules and laws. And then you're also watching the European economic community become quite successful.
That's
and you're like, well, we could have been in on the ground floor, but we said no.
Okay.
Now with Brexit coming about, it was an attempt by David Cameron to do two things. One, it was an election poll. It was an election, I won't say gimmick, but it was something he did because he wanted to shore up his base going into a general election. He wanted to have a united party. And he said, if we win, I will have a referendum. He could have done a lot of different things, but he said, if we win, we'll have a referendum. And it was to quiet that division within the conservative parties that existed when the question was originally posed, should we join, but was made worse by, as you pointed out, Thatcher. So it didn't work the way he wanted it to, clearly. And because he campaigned to stay, lost the referendum, which he, by the way, worded. He's the one who said, you know, he had advisors telling him, don't make this yet stay or go. Make it like, do you like us or not? You know, make it something that you gives you wiggle room. He's like, no, I'm confident we can do this. I'm going to renegotiate our terms. I'm going to win at the referendum. And he lost. And he's like, well, oh, well. We're on our way out.
Oh my God!
So and then he promptly resigned.
He resigned.
Forgive me for cursing. Well, a chicken shit move when you consider that you just got us into this, and now you're leaving before right. The actual leaving. Like, because Britain uncoupling from the EU was a painful.
It was. Yeah.
Right. Like that was really hard to do. So, you know, see ya. Like that's such a, sorry, that's a jerk move right there. Just a jerk move.
You know, I do think there's probably some personality dynamic at work there, you know, like you're maybe a feeling of embarrassment, but you also have to realize that the result of that election would have forced him to represent and engineer a policy that he was on record as against.
Yeah, so, he was opposed to it. I mean, so
yeah,
that's a fair point. Yeah. I mean, if you're being nice, that's fine.
But again, it comes back to if you're a politician or principal, at some point in time,
right.
You have to go ahead and say where is the line. Mm-hmm. And you know, truth be told, do you really want him to be the one negotiating? You know,
not if he doesn't want to negotiate, because not the guy you want in charge of things. Okay, that's fair. You guys are right. That's fair.
Yeah, I mean, he'd already negotiated slightly different terms, things that the EU would allow Britain to do differently over hot button issues that were being contested within this let's get out. Discourse. So he already had a package. He already had a plan, and he put it in front of the people and said, "Here's our plan. This is what the EU has agreed to, and this is what it will be like if we stay." And that wasn't enough. So again, you want to talk about that legitimacy of the prime minister? He lost a referendum to the general public. He can't possibly lead the party at that point if the party is going to legitimately contest future elections, but then also engineer, you know, to be beholden to the referendum. But I know what you want to talk about, right? You want to talk a little bit more about the repercussions of it all.
Yeah, right? I mean, because...
Well, I want to know if it's still reverberating through the political...
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Economy. If Texas suddenly left the United States, first of all, I would hold the door. But also, let me get that for you. But I mean, the repercussions of that would be generational. Like that would just be, because Texas is huge, right? We can't just uncouple something like that and have it not have huge effect. I assume that saying, "See you, European Union. We're now willing to pay 10 times the price for champagne that we were paying before because now we're foreigners." Right? Yeah.
Well, coincidentally, the price of food has seen the biggest jump in terms of like different sectors of the economy. The price of food went up, and this is pre-inflation. And that wasn't, you know, as much as you had a bigger marketplace for British farmers, which again was something that would appeal to British farmers in the electorate. Food prices have gone up for people, but first off, I'm still reeling from that Texas thing. The views on this podcast are not necessarily representative of the views of. Can we say something like this? Because now we're starting to really, I'm going to alienate a lot of people just by association. And I don't know if I'm ready for that.
I love Texas.
We could have used California as an example.
We could have used Montana. We could have used Maine. Anybody that's at the edge,
Right, you know, Florida.
We're opposed to anybody in the middle going, because then you have a big old hole in your country.
I love
C-note
it.
Note
equal
Quebec.
Equal opportunity alienation is what this is all about.
Right.
I admire you all for your verve and vigor.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we pull out we use the shotgun approach. You know, we aim for the mass, and we hope we hit something. No, seriously, right?
Well, So you were asking about Brexit is still an issue. Well, you know, I came across a phrase recently, which I thought was kind of clever, because you the mashup Britain and exit. Well, I came across regret.
Regret. Which is not a misspelled tattoo, it's a meme.
Yes,
it is now. Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah.
So you do have, I mean, the complexities of the dynamic, the voting dynamic, of Brexit are still reverberating, and that's where all of the questions you might ask about the economic benefits of Brexit, the benefits to British sovereignty, because one of the principal messages behind the campaign was the idea of reclaiming sovereignty, to getting back the ability to control your own fate, but along with it was this presumption that the British economy would not suffer to a great extent, and that it would actually be able to grow without being saddled by EU restrictions and
regulations.
So, but within the current discourse, you definitely have regret. You have people who, and I was actually reading something really interesting about this. So, polling numbers. Now that we're a couple of years out from both the referendum and actually leaving the EU formally, because that took a couple of years to make happen, you see two things happening. You do see some segment of the population saying they've changed their minds. They do regret voting to leave, which wasn't a huge majority, mind you. It wasn't. It was like less than right around 4 percentage points different.
Points, yeah.
And that is a really, really lousy thing. I mean, if you go and look at typical norms that govern referendums in Europe, they usually demand a higher percentage of the population voting in favor of the referendum for it to stick. No, that was enough. So they're on their way out. But anyway, you've got people who said, yeah, that maybe I wasn't the most informed, because there was a lot of misinformation swirling about that campaign. So they're like, okay, this isn't what we thought it was going to be. Those 300 million or 300 million pounds a week that could go to the NIH. Oh, you made that up. Wait a minute. So it's that buyer's remorse. But you also have changing demographics in the electorate as well, where you have a lot more of the British youth onboarding, and you have the older age cohort offboarding, which is my way of saying
dying.
Offboarding. I am like that? So gonna have that put on.
I don't want to alienate the dead. I just don't want
Nia,
that to happen.
born this year, offboarded this year.
Later.
That's so, awesome.
See, Chris, you don't know this. Nia and I are coming up with a merch line associated with the podcast.
Oh, offboarded 2024.
I love it. I love it. Okay. Hey, as long as I get a larger cut than I'm getting right now to appear on this thing, that's all I know. But the offboarding. So the offboarding, the idea that they're no longer participating in these polls kind of creates a little bit of a distortion when we see that more people now would vote to stay than they would or than they did in 2016, which implies that they changed their mind. It's not just a function of people changing their mind. Some people are. But it's also
the electorate has changed, right?
But it's 12-year-olds that are now 20. I mean, it's kind of thing.
Yeah, and if you looked at a lot of the support, it was a lot of the youth who were like, "This is our future. We think it's better if we are in the EU. We can see past a lot of the smoke and mirrors that were put in place during the Brexit campaign, during the Leave campaign." The deliberate even obfuscation of issues and lying even that went on to the general public to win this election. or win this referendum. Well, they could see through it. So now they're voting age, now they're participating in these polls, and those numbers have started to change and shift in that direction of, oh, this was maybe a bad idea. But what kind of stinks about all of it is that you have parties that were campaigning. You have people within parties of positions of power that have gone on record to saying, well, that's, again, a once in a lifetime referendum. Just if Labour wins the next referendum, as much as Keir Starmer, the current Labour Party leader, who would be presumably the prime minister, if there were an election today, Labour would likely win and he would be the prime minister. He said, I'm not going to turn around and go to Brussels and say, can we come back into the club? And that, so you've got this change of heart, but then you've got political parties who are saying, we're kind of stuck with this.
And is that a factor of British political culture? Because, you know, here in the United States, okay, you know, we get a changing presidential regime, okay, and, you know, policies that we may have spent hundreds of billions of dollars on in the past 8, 10, 12 years. Okay, well, hey, whatever, we're going in a different direction, right?
John, go ahead.
No. So, I mean, because political culture, you know this, I mean, with what you teach, political culture explains what can be done, but also what can't be done.
Yes.
Within a nation, right? And we oftentimes forget about how important political culture actually is, okay, in regards to, you know, policy decisions, policies that get considered, or in this case, being willing to go ahead and say, we screwed up.
Do you think that's a function of age, Chris? Like in 20 years, when all of the politicians who went through Brexit are gone, have been offboarded, will there be is there a possibility they could go back and rejoin the EU, assuming the EU still exists at that point? Could they rejoin the EU then? I mean, is this one of those things that's, you have to wait for that generation to go before you can consider? Or is this one of those things where the British are like, nope, we made a life-altering decision and we will stiff upper lip it and just deal?
Yeah. I mean, that's, you could see that attitude prevail. I think, right. So there is, and I'm going to, there's a mathematical answer to this too. And I know, is it another broken math thing? We have to think about, and this is a bit, this is not necessarily a British cultural phenomenon. It's simply a rational political party phenomenon. So, you know, what is the rational goal of a political party?
Stay in power.
Well, you want to
get elected and then stay.
Get in power and then stay in power.
Yeah, you win elections because you want to be in control of the government. Yeah.
So you have to walk. Right. And you have to, so to get to that point, you have to appeal to the electorate. And one of the things that happened in Brexit was you had this hidden electorate that all of a sudden never voted and came out to the polls. Now, I think that hidden electorate is dying off and then receding again because voting may not be for them after all, right? But you still have to dislodge the conservatives, because the conservatives right now are very clear. It's Brexit, no other options available. It's Labour that you could potentially play this as something to draw voters to them. But the question is whether that's going to be mathematically enough for them to displace the conservatives.
Yeah.
So if there are people in the middle that Labour can appeal to, but were people in the middle who were Brexit minded, then they've got to walk that tightrope of being kind of either ambiguous about plans or just coming out and saying no. So when Keir Starmer has come out to say no, that's when Labour has been at the polls much more vulnerable than it is right now. And I would also say that it is a reflection of election realities and the mathematics of a party that wants to get back in power. So you're going to take a position that isn't, like, it's not a position, you're not going to lose voters necessarily because you're saying that, in as much as you might gain voters who could be disaffected with the conservatives at this point.
No, I mean, you make a really good point here. I mean, because It's one of the challenges, Chris. You know this in teaching your classes, and I experience this when I teach Intro to U.S. Government. You know, students who are not all that interested in politics will say, yeah, you know, why did this party do X? And I'm like, okay, but you got to understand that they're trying to win elections, which means they may have to go ahead and on one hand say X, and then the next day say Y. They may not necessarily seem like they're compatible, but they are walking that really fine line because they want to come back into office. You know, political parties want to win elections. And that's why, you know, a party, you know, like Labor can, you know, have policies that may appeal to the youth, but they also have to go ahead and appeal to moderate older voters.
And if we go back to remember one of the important concepts from our first session together was that majoritarian system. There's a lot at stake when you lose and a lot at stake when you win. So if you are, like you say, you want to influence policy, well, you don't get, there is no influence of policy for second place in the British system. You're out, you're shut out.
Yeah.
So
it is one or nothing. You're either number one or you don't exist, basically, except to call for a vote of confidence at some point.
So you end up then with some moderating influences on, or influences that may lead officials to say go on the record about something when in their heart of hearts they would wish something different. But I know that we're probably running close on time here, so I want to squeeze one thing in that I think does respond, Nia, to one of your earlier questions, and it's about kind of the practical impact of Brexit. So Boris Johnson, despite his fumbling of COVID, actually kind of in a way benefited from it, because COVID had a huge impact on the global economy. And what that did is it masked the true impact of Brexit. And then furthermore, by depressing the economy, you have a catch-up effect as things start to kind of return to normal, which also could be used to say, hey, look, Brexit's not that bad. COVID gutted us, the economy-wise, and now we're rebounding from this. And look, it's Brexit isn't that bad. So what's the rebound from COVID is actually making Brexit look like a better policy decision than it really is. And then we have to add into this the war in Ukraine's impact on things too, because that kind of followed along pretty quickly. And that hit the energy sectors and also had an impact on the British economy, helped push inflation prices up. And that too disguises the impact of Brexit. Yeah. So when you're trying to
the impact of Brexit for years, right? Because all those other factors have to.
Yeah, I mean, these are
smooth out or shake down or whatever.
Yeah, because Chris, what you just mentioned are any number of intervening variables, that can go ahead and affect a nation's economy that are wholly unrelated to, you know, access to markets, the costs of regulations, you mentioned sovereignty. I mean, this idea that you get to make these decisions. Well, I mean, these are decisions that, you know, particularly the leaders of the Conservative Party can go ahead and say, but we're making the decisions on how we respond to X, right?
Yep.
And again, that mobilizes their base. But these intervening variables, those are really good points, Chris. Thanks.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that. But the, you know, because the United States elections live and die on the economy. If the economy is good, the incumbent wins a huge amount of the time. If the economy is not good, the incumbent is held responsible. But if your economy isn't, if it's not clear because there's all these other issues that are happening in addition to that, then I imagine that this won't be, that it, clear election results, you know, as far as the mandate of the people, quote, quote, which of course in England doesn't count because they don't know how to do math. But anyway, she said bitterly. But
again,
if they did
the views
know
on
how
this
to
podcast
that,
are not necessarily representative of all the participants.
So I can see where that's going to carry on for quite a while. Is the my last question, if you don't mind, is I know this is going to sound, I don't, I'm not trying to be difficult or divisive, although here I am. Does the British government work? Like, is it a pretty healthy, you know, I guess what I'm saying is a lot of people feel in the United States that our government right now is not working particularly well. We're very polarized. Mm-hmm. We're very sort of, right, there's this, and as Augie mentioned, I can't remember if it was this episode or last, the 12 junior members of Congress who managed to do all kinds of wonky stuff, right? That kind of is, does the British system work?
Oh,
for the most part?
It depends on who you ask, right? I mean, there's, but yeah, I think that there's, I mean, I guess the best way for me to answer that, since I know we are trying to wind things down, the best way for me to answer that is to say that at this moment, there is a lot of doubt in the Conservative Party's ability to govern Britain well. And it isn't just a function of Brexit. It isn't just a function of COVID. It isn't just a function of the Scottish National Party wanting to have a referendum to leave the United Kingdom. It's not a function. I mean, there's a certain stagnation that sets in when you've been in power for a long time. And sometimes it's more about a desire for change in as much as some sort of repudiation of your ideological agenda. And what's kind of interesting is the current Prime Minister Sunak has been, I would argue, much more successful and active dealing with some of the serious problems confronting Britain. Now, there are some controversies like the immigration policy that has been working its way through. But with like he's got a big policy win just the other day with this the Northern Ireland agreement that's going to restore restore participation of the Ulster, the DUP, the Ulster, the Unionist Party, and that is going to actually return the Northern Ireland Assembly back into action. It's going to try to address some of the issues, lingering issues from Brexit. But anyway, he's got some successes, but I was looking at the polls today, and it's been over the past year consistently, in terms of people who intend to vote for the Conservatives, he's hovering right around 25%, while Labour is in the 45 to 50% range. Wow. That says something about, even with these wins, you know, granted, he might get a bump, I'm not sure, and I'm not going to try to speculate about that, but it looks like he might be at that point where people are like, well, if you give me a vote now, I don't care. I'm going to vote for somebody else just to get an alternative into government. And it may be oversimplifying just a little bit to say that,
I know that you can't build in all the nuance because, I mean, I shouldn't have said, does it work, as a sort of broad that. You're writing a book about that, but that's Chris, a really interesting.
But Chris, you just mentioned something that I think we Americans tend to forget. I mean, if you look at this millennium in U.S. national politics, we had 8 years of Bush 43, and a significant percentage of those who voted for Obama, okay, wanted change. I mean, it was eight years of a Republican president. They wanted change, right?
A significant number of the people who wanted Donald Trump wanted change.
Change after 8 years.
Regular politician, somebody from outside the system.
Yeah.
They were looking for.
And Chris, what you mentioned was, you know, the Conservative Party had some self-inflicted wounds, right? I mean, and again, if you're already thinking this might be time for change, well, if you look at how they're governing, you're like, okay, well, maybe we should, you know, bring in the next bunch. Let's see what they can do.
Chris, would you be willing to come back after their election this year and talk to us about? Just sort of, I know you can't predict the future with your crystal ball and this is what's going to happen, but sort of a where you think this might take Britain Because whatever else is true about the United States and Britain, we remain the oldest allies. They remain our oldest allies, right? Like,
Sure. The
even when
special
we're crabby
relationship,
about
yeah.
their, right, even when we're
The
crabby
special
about their
relationship,
politics,
yeah.
that there is a special relationship. So, would you be willing to come back after their election and talk to us about what went well and what went wrong and all that stuff?
I'm tapped out. This
Okay.
is no, of
All
course.
right, that's it.
I would
I'm
love it. And I
done,
want to
Nia.
correct something. It
You
was
want to
the
know something? Read the London Times.
Right, exactly. Right. I'll just read some articles to you from my computer. No, I want to correct something. I said DUP. I said the Unionists. I want to be clear. It's the Democratic Unionist Party. That's the party that's coming back into the Assembly in Ireland. I want to come back and correct that. But I would love to come back and talk about it because I do think it's going to be interesting. Sunak inherited a big majority, and he has sat on it because I think he knows that if he went to the polls now, he had a really strong chance of losing. But and while I do think that that's probably the trend, I do think we're probably going to see a Labour government in the next after the next general election. A lot can happen this year, but I do think that that's the greatest likelihood. I'm not saying it's going to be a huge majority, but that would be my expectation. One of the things, though, is that these polls can be really unpredictable, and there have been moments, I mean, where it looked like one party was going to win the day and they didn't. And that's the case. That was the case with the Brexit referendum. That was the case with the last general election. There was some doubt, and then they come back with that huge majority. And you know the math is broken.
Yeah, they
Yes.
could poll at 75% and end up with three seats in parliament. So,
Let's do it. Yeah,
you
this is so
know.
much fun. I'm on board. You don't have to ask me twice. That'd be awesome to come back and talk about it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. This has not only
It's been
been
great.
educational, but also enjoyable. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Yes.
We feel very grateful that you were willing to spend the time with us. So thanks, Chris.
I really enjoyed it. It's not often that I get to slum it, and that
Well, I was going to offer to help you with your new podcast,
I wanted to change it up. On the end of the last one, I was praising you guys
you know
profusely. I
what? That's
just can't
true.
be a
You don't want
one-trick
us to get
pony.
ahead of, well, and you don't want us to get out over our skis because neither one of us, we're both clumsy, and that'll just end up as a mess.
We have to bring
Yeah.
it back down. All right. No, it was
Back
great. And
down.
you are still awesome. And I would love to just be a part of that. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Civil Discourse, brought to you by VCU Libraries. Opinions expressed are solely the speaker's own and do not reflect the views or opinions of VCU or VCU Libraries. Special thanks to the workshop for technical assistance. Music by Isaac Hobson. Find more information at guides.library.vcu.edu/discourse. As always, no documents were harmed in the making of this podcast.